Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're very welcome to this week's podcast. I'm Maurice O'Keefe, and this week's podcast is a fascinating interview with James Sheehan. He was one of the founders of BlackRock Clinic and Galway Clinic. He was well known in his early days for experimentation in finding out new ways to improve bone and joint diseases. I interviewed James at his own home in Dublin, and you will hear highlights of that interview in this week's podcast. I'm talking to Jimmy Sheehan here in BlackRock. But can we go right back to the beginning and tell me a little bit about your background?
Well, both my parents were from Kerry. My grandfather came from outside Kinmare, from Tussist, near the Healy Pass. My grandfather on my mother's side came from Tralee. He was a pharmacist in Tralee, and I happened to be born in Tralee. And every year spent 3 months of my life until I qualified. So I have a long association with Kerry.
Your education then, were they good days or bad days? How did you find it?
There were great days, but what amazes me when I look back on it, my father worked in the Dublin Port and Docks Board in a very ordinary secretarial job. And at one stage, he had four of us in third level education. He himself, his own father became ill just after my father left school. And my father had to get work at an early stage. And he always, I feel, had a great regret that he wasn't able to go on to higher education himself. And he put a great value in higher education. And as a result, we were all, it was a foregone conclusion that we would go into third level education.
Yeah.
And it must have been a great struggle when I look back to one stage to four of us at the same time in third level. My sister did medicine before me. My sister, who's after me in the family, did pharmacy. And then my younger brother and sister again did medicine. But we'd no contact with medicine at all other than with the pharmacy, because with my grandfather being a pharmacist, a number of his family were involved in pharmacy subsequently, the next generation.
And so what was your drive towards medicine? Why did you go that route?
I suppose when you look back, it's hard to know. But from the time I was young, I had a great interest in surgery. And in those days, there was no discussion about what you were going to do when you left school, because you did a leaving cert, and as long as you got your leaving cert, you could do anything. The only qualification for medicine was that you had to have Latin. And as long as you passed everything else, you could go into medical school. And I remember after I got my leaving certificate results, I'd never discussed with anyone what I was going to do. And my father said, "What would you like to do?" It was as casual as that. And I said, "I'd like to do medicine." And he said, "That's great," because he said, "I thought you might do engineering." Oh. As it happened, I subsequently did engineering and sort of combined the two of them. But that was the amount of discussion. Yeah. You know, in this day and age, you have counsellors and you have all sorts of nonsense going on and points and all the rest.
Yeah.
And I was very conscious from the time I went into medicine that my father had a great struggle to allow me to do medicine. Yeah. And I suppose I had an ordinary leaving certificate, just enough to get into college. And I decided, you know, that I'd been given the opportunity. And I studied day and night. And to my amazement, when the results of the first year came out, I was first in the class with first class honours. And I couldn't believe it, because there were so many in our class with scholarships and all sorts of high achievers, yeah, that I just couldn't understand that I could actually achieve what I did.
I know, that was a terrific
And it set a very high bar for me then, yeah, so that I had to continue at that level. And I did continue at that level, thank God,
yeah,
and qualified.
And who were your educators then? In what university?
University College Dublin.
Yeah.
There was a variety throughout the career, but I suppose when it came to the latter part of my career, my main mentor would have been Professor Patrick Fitzgerald, who was Professor of Surgery. Hmm. And he guided me then. He asked me after I qualified what I'd like to do. And I told him I'd like to go into orthopaedics.
Yeah.
And he said there's two essential qualifications for orthopaedics, because at that stage, orthopaedics wasn't very well developed. You put plasters on people, or you did very little. He said there's two essential qualifications. One is you need the strength of an ox and the brains of an ass. And he said, I'm worried about your strength. So that was my orthopaedic career.
So it was the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
And in those years...
Yeah.
Orthopaedic surgery was changing, wasn't it?
Orthopaedic surgery was very underdeveloped at that stage, because when I had my first job in orthopaedics in Kappa, most of the people there were children. Most of the patients were children. They were suffering from polio, tuberculosis, and congenital problems, like congenital hip problems. Very few adults, because there was very little that was being done. There was no joint replacement. There was no internal fixation of bones. There was nothing of that nature going on. And it was a very different... In fact, everything that I trained in at that stage is no longer applicable, because polio has been wiped off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And that those are common diseases that were then are no longer applicable.
But you can imagine the pain, the suffering that people endured because, you know, there was no hip replacements or knee replacements.
And that was the great challenge, because fractures at that stage were treated by, like, if you had a fractured femur, you put somebody in bed for 3 months, you put a pin through their knee and put them on traction for 3 months. And it was a fairly crude science. And I suppose what attracted me to it is I loved carpentry. And I was... I pottered around a fair bit with timber, and I liked the concept of combining the skills of carpentry with bone surgery rather than soft tissue surgery.
I just can imagine sawing through the bone.
Yeah, these things just sort of influence you in life at an early stage.
Yeah.
And I suppose the great challenge then was when I was training, I had the great fortune to work with Sir John Charnley, who was the original designer of the artificial hip joint. And that really was a definitive moment in my life. I was training and I worked with him for a year and was introduced to the whole concept of artificial joints. And during that year, I did a lot of hip surgery with him. And at that stage, we couldn't do very much for anywhere else, because people who had bad arthritis in their knees, we replaced their hips, but we couldn't do anything for their knees. All we could do was stiffen their knee permanently, so at least they had a stiff knee and that they could walk on it, as against a very deformed knee. And I got interested then in knee development. And while I was with him, I sort of started...
So where were you at this stage?
I was in Lancashire in Wrightington Hospital.
And so when you were there with him, you were learning all this new way of doing surgery.
Not alone doing surgery, but we had a workshop attached to the hospital, and we all had to undergo instruction. In fact, I went to the local technical school as well, and learned how to work a lathe and milling machine. And as a result, then in the workshop, we made a lot of our own instruments, and we finished off the artificial joints and put them in. We'd be locked up nowadays for doing it with regulations. You know, they were great days because you had the freedom. We'd make something and put it into somebody, sterilise it.
This was all experimental.
And this was all experimental because there was nothing else you could do for people. And it was a fantastic eye-opener as to how much could be achieved. So because I got very involved in the whole metallurgical aspect and in joint design at that stage, I decided that in order to further my interest, I'd have to go back and study engineering. So the following year, I went back to the University of Guildford and signed up for bioengineering, which was a combination of, they'd only just started the course the year before. And I spent a year there, and then subsequently I worked with the university on a PhD and got a PhD in engineering from them some years later.
I see. So now you were a qualified engineer.
I had enough skills to know who to contact as to who you could use productively for knowledge.
How much did this stand to you? Being a qualified engineer as well as an orthopaedic surgeon.
I think it stood enormously to me, really.
In what way now?
Well, I was the first to have ever combined those two at a university level. And it gave me a great interest in furthering the engineering aspects because I wasn't afraid to approach people about problems. What I learned in the time with engineering was who I could approach, because I didn't have great knowledge myself, but I knew who had the skills and what areas was it in, sort of photoelasticity for fatigue of components, or was it in other metallurgical aspects, or what area. And that was a great background. It sort of took the mystique out of it for me, because when I was in the university in Surrey, they were very advanced in some aspects of metallurgical design. For example, they were doing a lot of work on the Concorde at that time, design work on the turbines. And they also did work on the turbines for the QE2, which had been just, the new QE2 was just launched at that time. And I don't know if you remember, back in those days, on its maiden voyage, it had turbine problems. Some of the propellers broke in the turbine. And the University of Surrey were engaged to do the metallurgical research on it.
Oh, no, that's
so
interesting.
They were very advanced in photoelasticity, which is a science for you reproduce the metal in plastic and then you subject it to stresses, and you can see there where the stresses are concentrated. So there was a whole new area open to me.
And you had new material now to work with. And am I right in saying that?
Well, we were working mainly in stainless steel in those days.
Yes.
But then subsequently other materials, chrome cobalt and other materials, which had superior fatigue lives, because some of the earlier stainless steel joints underwent fatigue. Mm-hmm. And after so many millions of cycles, the joint was in danger of breaking.
How exciting was it to be in that? You know, you were there, you were discovering, you were finding out the new methods of doing these operations. It must have been very exciting.
It was very exciting. It was great. There were great days, really. You know,
Where did that lead you to then?
Well, after 4 years, nearly 5 years abroad, I came back to the staff. St. Vincent's Hospital had just been relocated to the new hospital in Ellen Park in 1970. Was relocated from Stephen's Green, from the old hospital. And I was appointed to the staff there and to the staff of Kappa Hospital. As a result of my mentor, the late Professor Patrick Fitzgerald, sort of opening the door for me, because in those days, in a voluntary hospital, when you got a job, I never sent a curriculum in.
Yeah.
I never wrote an application. You were just appointed to the staff, and you were welcome to the staff, and you went and met the Mother General.
Yeah.
And she shook hands with you, and that was your appointment.
Oh, And you're in.
But in those days, the voluntary hospital, people forget about what voluntary hospitals were, meant voluntary hospital. You worked on a voluntary basis in the hospital, but you made your livelihood by a certain percentage of the patients that were treated had private insurance.
How it worked.
But otherwise it was voluntary. So you actually worked on a voluntary basis.
So explain that to me. You were there working 9 to 5 or whatever.
All the hours of the day. And night.
Yeah. And all of this, you weren't paid, but then you got paid through the insurance of the patient.
If they were privately covered. And because of the location of St. Vincent's in South Dublin, at that stage about 30% of people had private insurance. So you made your livelihood out of that. There was another system, I don't know, people nowadays forget about the hospital trust, the Irish Hospital Sweepstake. They paid a stipend to the voluntary hospitals to contribute towards the staff. At that stage, when I was appointed in 1970, they paid £1 per occupied bed in the hospital. And that was divided then amongst all the consultant staff. Which wouldn't pay for coffee in the morning, but that was the system of payment from the voluntary point of view. But after 17 years in the public system, I retired from it for various reasons. I was working after 17 years. I set up the joint replacement unit in Kappa when I came back to Ireland in 1970. It opened in 1971. And we had a research workshop and a special operation theatre. And that Kappa now is the second largest joint replacement unit in the British Isles. So it's
extraordinary.
Yeah. So I set that up in 1971.
Can you remember in 1971 when you did set it up, who was there with you?
I basically set it up on my own. Yeah. Now, there were other people on the staff, my senior colleagues, who were a lot more senior to me. It was Paddy McCauley, Joe Gallagher, Niall Mulville. They were colleagues of mine, but much more senior to me. But I was the one interested in the joint replacement and set it up. And then I built that up over, and they also performed artificial joint replacements, but I built that up to such a level in the early 80s. By 1981, I had a 5-year waiting list for people, and I just couldn't cope with it. And the government, in their wisdom, at that stage decided for cutbacks in healthcare, which is this cyclical business that happens all the time. And they decided that they couldn't stop people having acute problems like an acute appendicitis, but that they wouldn't fund elective surgery like joint replacement, so they wouldn't pay for artificial joints.
Yeah.
So at that stage, I was doing about 10 replacements a week, and I was told at that stage that I would be rationed to 2 joints a fortnight. So that's instead of 20 a fortnight, I could do 2. That's 1/10 of what I was doing.
Isn't that crazy?
And I had a 5-year waiting list.
Yeah.
And I sat down with my wife at that stage and we said, well, look, you know, I've spent the last number of years trying to develop skills, and I either emigrate and use them somewhere else, or I try and do something positive about it. And that was how Black Rock Clinic evolved, by default.
So the frustration of not being able to do what you wanted to do
drove me to do something positive.
Which turned out amazing. Yeah. But to talk about the early days, how did Black Rock Clinic come about? How did you get started?
Well, what happened was I just couldn't do the surgery. Except in a very limited amount. And I decided that, you know, if I could develop a hospital that was devoted for the high-tech area, which was largely underdeveloped in Ireland, because apart from Kappa, the only other area that had joint replacement was a small unit in Mount Carmel, which I'd set up in the private hospital. But that was only a small unit and couldn't handle a lot of work. So I decided, and we set about, and we said, look, if we can get a group of doctors together, fund a consulting complex and put a group of high-powered practitioners together who would then service a hospital particularly at the high-tech end. At that stage, the late Morris Nelligan had a similar problem to myself. He had about a 5-year waiting list for cardiac bypass. And I met Morris, and there was another colleague of mine, George Duffy, who was in nuclear medicine, which was very constrained because it was a new area as well. And I said, look, if we can get all these areas going, at least we can cope with 1/3 of the population who are covered privately.
Okay.
And if the state can't afford it, well, at least we can do 1/3 of it, take them away from the state, and at least then those who go into the public hospitals can be covered. And if they only want 2 operations every now and again, well, that's as far as the state can do. I can't control it. And that was the advent of BlackRock. So,
can you remember those meetings that you had? You know, you were all sitting down and you were trying to fund, you were trying to get money to build this. And
I can remember them very vividly because I tell you, they weren't easy days in those days, because in 1980, there was a similar type recession, really, as we went through in the 10 years ago, and it was difficult. But I was very lucky. There was a bank manager who was head of Guinness Mahon Bank that I had operated on. And at that stage, I usually did rounds late at night after operating for the day. I'd come home for a while and then go back and do rounds at night. And I was visiting this bank manager late at night, having replaced his hip. And he said, you know, he said, you have a desperate lifestyle. He said, I see it night and day working. And that, he said, you know, you obviously have no time to manage your own affairs. If I can ever help you, he said, you know, give me a shout. So a few months later, I rang him and I said, how would you be fixed for a quick million? Now, a million in 1980 was a lot of money. But there was a site in BlackRock that had come on the market, a 5-acre site with an old house on it. And I thought that would be an ideal setting for a clinic. And he said, count me in. And
It happened, a phone call.
My late cousin, Jim Sheehan, who was a solicitor, with his son, Jerry, who is now my solicitor, went to the auction. And I said, up to a million. And they bought it for just under a million. And it was the highest price recorded for land in Dublin up to that, and that was the start. And once I had the first million borrowed, I had to go on from there. So it was a chance
meeting, so with the Guinness Mahon,
and his foresight, that he trusted what I was doing. He believed in what I wanted to do.
So Morris Nelligan was on board, as was
George Duffy. My brother lived in America. He was he went to America after he qualified to the Mayo Clinic, and he was training to be a rheumatologist on the basis that rheumatology is the medical side of bone and joint disease, and that he would come back and we would practice. And then he decided, after some years of rheumatology, that all the cures in rheumatology were surgical, and he switched and he became an orthopaedic surgeon. And he was due to come back to Ireland then, so I sort of signed him in as one of the original people as well. So there were 4 of us originally, but I did 99% of the work.
Okay. How busy were you then?
Oh, I was very busy. I was working night and day. At that stage, I was on the staff of Vincent's Kappa, worked in Vincent's private hospital and Mount Carmel. And then when BlackRock opened in BlackRock. I was between 5 different places. And then after some years, I rationalised it. And I said, after 17 years in the public system, I'd never been able to achieve anything in the public system.
I
tried to establish a major trauma centre for the East Coast, because at that stage, working in Vincent's, I covered the trauma down as far as Wexford. And I went down to Wexford to do a clinic every month. And then the trauma from Wexford was all sent up to Vincent's. So we covered the East Coast for internal fixation.
That was extraordinary.
I was interested in internal fixation too, because it wasn't just joint replacement. But when I was in England, in fact, studying in the University of Surrey, I was put in contact with a group in Switzerland who were starting to develop bone plates and screws for fracture fixation. And they were called the AO group, and there were a few well-known surgeons involved in it. And I became involved with them, went over to Switzerland, and then became a one of the founding members of their group. And
what was it called?
AO, Association for Osteosynthesis. And I was on their board of trustees, one of the original members of the board of trustees. So I was very involved with fracture treatment. Mm. And when I came back to Ireland, I actually, my wife and myself, collected all the instruments from Switzerland, had the car loaded with the instruments, brought them back to Vincent's and started internal fixation in Vincent's. So it was a whole new way of treating fractures. That if you had a fractured arm, you put in a plate and screws into it and people started moving straight away.
Yeah.
And it revolutionised the whole concept of fracture treatment, but added a whole new area of complexity to surgery, because before, what you might stick into a plaster, you now spend maybe a few hours doing very precise surgery to reconstruct their fracture.
Yeah, of course.
A lot of my work was in that area,
yep,
in Vincent's.
Looking back over the years that you spent in medical care, is there anything you would change if you could?
It's very hard to say when you look back, because things happen. And I suppose I always had an attitude that I was open to change. And I had a feeling as well that every decade you should have a different emphasis in your life. Because if you're doing the same thing day in, day out, for 50 years, you become stale. But medicine forces you to change. So that every decade, I actually happened to really have a different emphasis. It was always healthcare, but initially it was training, studying and training, then coming back and being very involved in the development of joints, then developing hospitals. And one of the most exciting times I had was the last decade where I was running a hospital. I decided that after developing the hospital in Galway, there were problems. It wasn't performing well financially, and there were also problems with CEOs. And I decided I'd take on the job as CEO for a 5-year period. Mm. And that was one of the most interesting periods of my lifetime, to take that on.
And why?
There was a few reasons. Blackrock was in the 80s, and it was at an early stage when I was sort of totally raw to the whole concept of development. By the time I got involved in Galway, I had a lot more experience, and there were a lot of things that I wanted to do. And I realised that you can build a hospital, you can have a board, and you can have things running. But unless you're on the ground as a CEO, you don't make things happen. And I was able to do a huge amount in that 5 years in terms of innovation. And also too, my two sons became involved with me, and one of them worked with me down there for 10 years, very closely. And we had an extraordinary time together, because in his youth, I never saw him because I was out working. And we had those 10 years together, which were an extraordinary period where we did a huge amount of innovation in hospital efficiency, if you like. We introduced a lot of computerization. We introduced a lot of innovation in every aspect of healthcare. And I was able to do that because I was on the ground, and I said, look, tomorrow we'll do so-and-so, and it happened.
You can't do
that through a board. If you're on a board, you make general decisions.
Okay.
And so it
was this hands-on effect.
Hands-on effect for actually running healthcare.
On the premises there.
Yeah. And I think it's something that I'd love to see a lot more people, as they come towards the end of their surgical or medical career, to go into hospital administration. Mm-hmm. Because in my early years, when I worked in Glasgow, the first job I had out of Ireland, in Glasgow at that stage, or in Scotland, the hospital was run by a medical administrator who was a qualified doctor.
Okay.
And that was the original structure of hospital CEOs. He then had an accountant helping him, and he had others helping him. But he had a great understanding as to what was necessary for patients. Now our CEOs are accountants and non-medics in most hospitals. They don't really understand the medical side of it. And I'd love to see the old-fashioned hospital administrator coming back in, because I think we'd have a much, much more efficient and patient-centered delivery of healthcare.
Because it's all the experience that you build up over your career.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
You have to your benefit when you are running a hospital.
Yeah. And you understand what the patient needs. And also too, you have a great understanding of dealing with your colleagues as well. Because they're not easy to deal with very often, because we're all independent republics, and
How did you find yourself with people? Were you a good people's person too?
I wouldn't say I was a great people's person, but I had an understanding, I suppose, of what was needed. And I respected people hugely for what they did. And I think that you can get an enormous amount of good out of people if you work alongside them.
Okay.
But I think you have to be on the shop floor. And I had various principles when I was in Galway. For example, I had no office, because I felt if you had an office, you were locking yourself away. So the time I was in the hospital, I was on the shop floor, and I went around from one department to the other. If I wanted to meet somebody, I either met them in their room, or I'd bring them into an empty room and we'd sit down. But don't lock yourself away in an office. Be available.
Could you explain to me you've been in private care now for the majority of your life.
Yeah.
And the comparison, is it, if you're lucky enough to afford private care, is this?
Well, sadly, that's the way it looks, that if you can afford it. But really, the healthcare should be a one-tier level for everybody. But unfortunately, that is a wish that will never, ever be met, because no country in the world can afford healthcare for everybody at the level that's expected. Therefore, there will always be a division, and it's a huge problem. How do you actually tackle it? And it depends very much on, are the state willing to put up the resources to give everyone adequate care? Because if you end up with a one-tiered level of care, you're really going for the lowest common denominator.
Right.
And if you want to set your bar higher and give a higher level of service, like, for example, should people be waiting for 2 years for an MRI scan as against having one tomorrow? And that, to me, is the difference. The state should be able to provide the MRI scan tomorrow for everybody, the same as we do in the private sector.
Yeah.
And it's not right to deprive people of that. And this is the whole sort of problem about private versus public care, really.
But going back to the beginning of this interview, you spoke to me about voluntary service in a public hospital.
Yeah.
Do you think this is something that system, which is gone now?
It's totally gone. Is gone. And you know, it was a great system and worked very well, because we gave of our very best, and you did exactly the same for someone who couldn't afford to pay as for someone who could afford to pay. They were both treated exactly the same. There was no difference in any way. But unfortunately, the voluntary system has gone, and everybody is now an employee. I never took a contract. The contracts were introduced in the 80s, around the time I got involved in BlackRock. But I never took a contract, because at that stage, when they introduced the contract, they were already cutting back on the services. And I refused to take a contract to work X number of hours when I hadn't the facilities to even work.
I know.
And even now you have a lot of doctors who are on a contract and they can't get into theatre, and they're not allowed work the hours they're contracted to do, and yet they have to pay them for doing those hours. So our whole public system has actually collapsed.
Yeah.
And I think the way it's administrated and run is a disaster in a lot of areas.
But when we have people, you've stepped back now, have you?
I have. Oh, yeah, I'm out. Yeah, from the time my wife got sick about 2 years ago, and I just got out of everything.
Yeah.
So I've no involvement.
And do you miss it at all?
Well, you know, she was sick, and I was so privileged to be able to look after and care for her for the last, particularly the last year of her life, that was meant everything to me. I've no great desire to get back into healthcare because it's got more complicated. There are aspects of it, like the medical, legal aspects of it, which are out of hand. You see the claims going in, and the sort of the whole insurance industry has gone mad. That aspect of doctors looking over their shoulder, wondering, did they do the right thing? You were there and you did your very best for everybody. Yeah. But in my time, we weren't looking over our shoulder. Yeah. So I think I had the best of times. Yeah. And it was fantastic to have the opportunity of being able to develop and to be involved at the cutting edge. And I think I'd find it frustrating to go back in now with the amount of regulation. I think even when you look at EU regulations, there's a regulation for everything. You know, and life has become over-regulated, and I think it's interfering greatly with the standard of care.
Jimmy Sheehan, it's been a pleasure talking to you. This has been an amazing interview. Thank you so much.
Privilege to be able to do so. Thank you.
Well, we've come to the end of this week's podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to James Sheehan, and if you would like to hear his full interview, you can do so by going to irishlifeandlaw.com. I'm Maurice O'Keefe, and I hope to bring you another podcast next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.